From Community Public Radio, this is CPR Sunday. In New York, I'm Don DeBar with Mark Sloboda from Moscow. Mark, welcome back. Glad to have you, as always.
Don, it's an honor and a pleasure. To all the listeners out there, it's always great to be on CPR.
So, let's see, the cessation of hostilities that isn't a ceasefire, that isn't a peace deal, that covers areas smaller than the Vatican in Syria.
Yes. So, a few weeks ago, we had a agreement at Munich, supported by a Security Council resolution, that called for a ceasefire in Syria. That ceasefire was delayed by a week, and it looked like it wasn't going to happen. One of the reasons specifically for this, according to the Washington Post and Reuters, last week, was that the U.S. was insisting that Jabhat al-Nusra, that is al-Qaeda's franchise in Syria, as recognized by the U.S. government under law and the U.N. Security Council as a terrorist organization and something that two Security Council resolutions call for eradicating in Syria. They call for eradicating it, ISIS, and all individuals, entities, and endeavors that associate with either one of them. If you know anything about what's happening on the ground in Syria, you're well aware, whether you're reading the Washington Post, the Guardian, the Telegraph, the New York Times, they all will admit to you that the Jabhat al-Nusra and the West-backed moderate rebels are in close proximity. They're fighting alongside each other. They are in tight formation, or they are Westerns are embedded in the much larger Jabhat al-Nusra forces. That is to say that they are allies. They are certainly associates. And, you know, if you can't find rebels anywhere in Syria that aren't working with al-Qaeda, for some reason the U.S. government and the Western media doesn't have a problem with that. And I do, because when I served in the military, al-Qaeda was the enemy. They weren't the ally of our proxies for regime change in another country. And I'm just amazed. I think President Obama, who has led our country into a very, very dark place in pursuit of some kind of hegemonic geopolitical regime change in Syria, I think he should have to go to the families of the victims of 9/11 on his hands and knees and ask them why he was asking Russia to stop attacking al-Qaeda in Syria as part of a ceasefire deal. You know, this was in those terms. There's no if, ands, or buts about it. This was reported in the Washington Post and Reuters. And according to a source close to the talks in Reuters, this was the elephant in the room, quote unquote, about the negotiations. Because what this does is it really reveals the true nature of the West-backed rebels and what is going on in Syria, and that the nature of the conflict is indeed almost entirely one of a sectarian Salafist jihad against everyone else in Syria. And we're on the wrong. The U.S., you know, the West and their Gulf dictatorship allies are on the wrong side of this. So now they've agreed on a lesser something lesser with less legal responsibilities than a full ceasefire. This is a cessation of hostilities. This is what was agreed to in the last week between the U.S. and Russia. The fact that it's the U.S. and Russia directly negotiating with each other at this point with no one else in the room shows you, one, that they're a little bit more serious than they have been. But two, again, they also show you that this, this civil war inside a jihad, inside of a regional proxy war, is now a war over world order a la the Cold War, although it's really more about great power conflict than about and world order than some type of ideological struggle. But this is directly between the U.S. and Russia and each sides they represent at this point. The cessation of hostilities that was agreed to is only good for 2 weeks. It can be renewed. You had to sign up for this. It's not something that applies across the board, which was a very smart move on Russia's part. Thus far, Russia says almost 100 rebel groups have signed up to this. That sounds pretty good. Until you remember, you know, as reported by the New York Times and so on, there are about 1,500 rebel groups.
Right.
And the U.S., the Russia has set up a center in Syria to handle rebels who are applying and monitor the ceasefire. Supposedly, the U.S. is doing the same thing. Now, we know from the Russian press that they turned a list of the groups, the numbers, and the specific areas to which the cessation of hostilities over to the U.S. I haven't heard anything about the U.S. adding anything to this list from their side. Their side is being assembled in Amman, Jordan. So as far as we know, there are some almost 100 groups, some 6,111 rebel individuals, and the area covered, you can find the maps online if you look for it's released by the Russian Ministry of Defense. It's on Sputnik. It's on my own social media. You can find it out there. It's probably a small slivers of yellow territory that comprise maybe 3% of Syria. That is the only people and areas that are affected by this cessation of hostilities. Anything else in the country is still fair game. On top of this, Turkey has said outright that they do not consider the ceasefire binding on them. And the word out today, just less than 24 hours after it went, or a little over 24 hours after it went into effect, because it was Friday at midnight, is that Turkey is shelling inside Syria again, into Kurdish areas. We have word that some 100 or more attackers are attacking Kurdish, Western and Russian-supported Kurdish forces of the Syrian Democratic Forces. 100-some attackers attacking out of Turkey their proxies into Syria as well. So obviously these are violations. There have been sporadic other violations. Quite definitely, we know for certain that Jabhat al-Nusra, al-Qaeda, is not a part of this ceasefire. Neither, of course, is ISIS. Neither is Ahrar al-Sham, which is the other big jihadist group that is an offshoot of al-Qaeda. And neither is Jaish al-Islam, which was part of the Riyadh Jamboree, this high negotiation committee. And they have been shelling Damascus with mortars, the Damascus suburbs, since the ceasefire went into effect, almost without remit. So Russia's goal of all of this, as far as I can tell, is to make whatever moderate rebel forces there are out there disassociate themselves. This is a divide and conquer strategy. If you want to live, if you want to be part of a political transition, this is it. The game is over. You have to separate from al-Qaeda and whoever else jihadis are on the field. And basically lay down your weapons. And if you don't, then you're toast. We're going to continue bombing you, and the Syrian army is going to continue rolling you over. And the U.S. has very reluctantly agreed to this. They're sounding very skeptical, perhaps even more skeptical than the Russians are. And the Western press is even more skeptical than the U.S. government, because they realize that they're being called out on this, that they're – about the actual nature of the rebels, the rebellion, the jihad, whatever you want to call it, and how many actually moderate forces there are out there. And this is a kind of a test time now. There is a possibility between peace, not in peace in Syria, because we see that it doesn't affect most of the combatants, but it's an exit ramp, an opportunity for the U.S. And Europe to walk away from this with a little, holding their head at least a little high, and hopefully a chance for them to call off their rabid dogs in Turkey and Saudi and Qatar, although I doubt very much about how much actual control Obama is able to exert on them, because he hasn't exhibited very much. He's a very weak and feckless president. Maybe we should be glad that he hasn't agreed to an invasion Syria earlier, as many people, as many neocons and pundits in the U.S. would have liked to have him have done.
Still.
And certainly Saudi and Turkey. Yes, yeah, and still Saudi and Turkey would like him to do. And we should remember, just in the last week, Kerry was making threats, again, outright threats, that if this the cessation of hostilities doesn't work, and we know that it doesn't cover the vast, vast majority of the so-called rebel combatants on the field in Syria. So basically, if the U.S. isn't happy with the results, then Kerry says there is active consideration in Washington of a plan B. And he specifically then referenced that it may be difficult to keep Syria together.
Right.
That is partition. That is what we've been talking, Eric and I have been talking about for weeks on your show, that this was down the road, that it was a distinct possibility, that Saudi and Turkey would be behind it. They would be the ones probably moving into eastern Syria, backed up by U.S. air power and special forces in the U.K. as well, if that happens. And if that happens, you know, we're one step closer to direct great power conflict between the United States and Russia. But further, it also gives all of the combatants, rebel combatants on the field, Turkey and Saudi Arabia, an excuse to break it, because Kerry's outright saying, if we're not happy with what comes out of this, ceasefire that's not a ceasefire,
we're coming in.
Yeah. Then we're coming in. And of course, that's what they all want.
Right.
So that's a very dangerous thing for Kerry to say, I believe. It's not only belligerent, it's also giving these belligerent Islamist forces, both the rebels and their backers in Turkey, Saudi, and Qatar, an incentive to break it.
Yeah. And, you know, I want to get to how the domestic political scene here bears on that, because you have, whether it's Saudi lobbying, Israeli lobbying, whatever the dynamics are behind the scene, and certainly within the government on their own initiative, many people that want a direct U.S. involvement. But you have the Republicans all essentially saying Obama's weak because he didn't invade Syria, and we'll take care of that problem as soon as we get in. There's like that whole dynamic, and I want to get to that in a minute. But what I really want to get to first is something you said towards the beginning about the Russian involvement since September 30th, essentially putting into relief what the U.S. role and the goals,
yes,
and the purposes and the relationship of the U.S. to all of these groups really is.
Yeah, I've referred to it on other media that I believe that Russia is taking a look at these negotiations, again, as giving it the U.S. an exit ramp. They don't really believe that they on their own can bring peace to Syria. I mean, to do that, you have to close the borders to Turkey and Jordan on the ground, and you have to get Saudi and Turkey to stop what they're doing, and to a similar extent the U.S. But I think Russia views it as a kind of seven-step group therapy for the West. to sit down, hold their hands, and help them come to grips with the fact that they have been illegally supporting violent jihad to overthrow another government in the Middle East, that it would end up even worse, considering the much more important geopolitical and bigger population size than Libya, which the West is once again sending forces in a kind of you broke it, you bought it deal,
yeah,
I
yeah,
guess.
Right, yeah.
That has come out, that the U.S. and France have forces and the U.K. have forces on the ground in Libya again.
Yeah.
Again.
Yeah.
But, guys, come to your senses. Come to grips with this fact, because you've been denying it for years now, and walk away. The position of Saudi and Turkey and, of course, to a lesser extent, Qatar, because they're not going to walk away. Can the U.S. walk away? leaving Saudi and Turkey out on this, because they, I don't believe that they will back down. Too much political, economic capital is invested. Obama is, we know that the U.S. is divided. There's different arguments in the Pentagon, the CIA, the State Department, the White House. No one agrees. Some people say more should have been done. Some people say less should have been done. Some said we should go to war with Russia. Some said that, you know, Russia should actually, you know, we can come to terms with them as a kind of allies and all of this, you know, depending on what the, whether that individual's perception of the U.S.'s national interest is fighting ISIS or still regime change in Damascus. So it's a big mess. And I think a big part of it is Obama's inability to lead the state institutions in the U.S. His lame duck status has only made that work, you know, on top of his history of 5 years. He's dipped his foot in. He was willing to try to regime change Syria by proxy, and he's invested billions of U.S. taxpayer dollars in that, you know, funding this hellacious war over there for 5 years. But he hasn't so far committed U.S. troops to direct invasion and occupation of Syria. Yeah. And I'm leaning towards that he won't in the end, because, you know, the realities on the ground continue to make it more and more difficult for him to do that. But without a doubt, I do believe that that was directly averted, you know, whether it was U.S. forces or U.S.-backed Saudi and Turkish forces. But that was on the game plan for this this fall or this winter at the latest. And the Russian troop insertion directly checked that. That would have happened if Russia hadn't gone in. With, you know, we have to acknowledge Russia's doing this with a fairly small force.
Yeah.
There's only 50-some aircraft, a few thousand support troops, that which includes, you know, base security, pilots, some advisors, certainly some advisors and special forces probably in the field, but, you know, no major ground units or anything like that. It's a relatively modest expeditionary force.
Well, you know what?
But it has had a huge effect on the battlefield,
yeah,
primarily because Russia has very intelligently created an alliance and cooperated with Iran and with the Iraq and their Shiite militias and with Hezbollah and stolen the Kurds, in effect, away from the United States. Mm-hmm. It was very funny earlier this week when the British Foreign Secretary Hammond made a statement that he finds it very disturbing the way that the Kurds seem to be operating in cooperation with the Syrian government forces. Well, I'm just – these limeys are a little slow on the uptake,
yeah,
aren't they?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, the Kurds have never really fought the Syrian government, right. And they have been fighting, you know, not only ISIS, but the, you know, the U.S.-backed FSA, as well as all the other even more jihadist forces out there. I don't know why he's surprised or disturbed by this.
Right.
I'm a little disturbed by his reaction to being disturbed by this, because it shows he's completely out of touch with what's been happening for years on the ground now.
Let me ask you something. First, I want to ask, do you think that Obama's problem is that, actually, before I go there, although Russia has been, you know, very judicious use of a very small amount of force applied very accurately, you know, the reason that Syria didn't go the way of Libya in the first place was more or less just the insertion of one Russian into a Security Council vote that barred the air cover that was supposed to be given to the jihadists in Syria. That was Russia and China, I don't know, three times, four times, but, you know, at the very first time when it wasn't going, it was basically said, no, you're not going the way of Libya, you can't use your air force.
Yes, and they did the exact opposite in Libya.
Right.
Both Russia and China abstained from the vote that the U.S. And the West then, you know, there's no question that they completely, you know, went out of bounds of that resolution and used it as a fig leaf, not for the humanitarian intervention that it called for, but due to the wording of it, they argued that allowed them to overthrow the Libyan government by military force, bombing, what turned out to be, jihadist warlords into power, the failed state that Libya has become since then.
Right.
And this happened when Medvedev was president of Russia.
That's
and
right.
I think it definitely shows that Medvedev and the forces around him were given far greater power than is generally considered. It's generally considered that Putin was really directly controlling things from the position of prime minister during those 4 years. I think it shows exactly the opposite, that it was Medvedev that agreed to this. Putin voiced opposition to it at the time, public opposition, difference between the president and the prime minister. Sources close to the president, some of his advisors, have suggested what a lot of us have thought for a long time, that when this, what happened in Libya and the West's betrayal and the abuse of this resolution and showing, despite a Democrat in office being still willing to pursue regime change around the world in pursuit of hegemony, convinced Putin that he needed to come back and resume the presidency. Because the world was still going through this very difficult time where the multipolar world is trying to give birth to, itself.
Right.
But hegemony is still trying to claw that back.
Yeah.
And Putin, I believe, felt he needed to, have that his strong helm at the country. And someone like Medvedev, who, whether naively or for whatever reason, was willing to trust a duplicitous West again and again, certainly the powers that are in control of the Kremlin, Putin and those around him, they're not going to fall for that this time. And you shouldn't mistake this cessation of hostility, what's going on in the Syria situation or in Ukraine, with what happened in Libya, because I believe a line has been drawn in the sand, and the Russian government and, I believe to a lesser extent, China and Iran, are backing them up, saying never again.
Let's say, just for argument's sake, that perhaps Putin did have influence at the time, and what Medvedev did was actually done to set the scene for what's happening in Syria now, because no one has any illusions anymore. It certainly rolled the curtain back some on the United States when they acted as the air force for what became current Libya, jihadi Libya, failed state Libya.
Yeah.
It's hard for them to then say, well, we need to do this no-fly zone in Syria to protect the Syrian people.
Well, it hasn't stopped anyone in the Western governments from saying that exact same thing.
Of course, but nobody buys it Libya. Anymore.
No one in the Western media, there's so few voices recalling, hey, do you just remember what happened a few years ago in Libya?
Right.
Or a few years ago what happened in Iraq, which of course led to the creation of ISIS as well, and this rebirth of the whole situation across the Iraqi-Syrian border with the Islamic State. There's very few voices, even in the press, saying that. And the number of politicians in both Washington and London and the continent and in the EU that are actually saying this is a handful. I can count them on my hands.
You know what gets me? I mean, you got Sanders in this life and death, quote unquote, primary against Clinton. If I were him, my TV ads would feature Hillary Clinton saying, "We came, they saw, he's dead," and yet he's touched Libya a few times, but he hasn't gone for the gusto. And the only one who really has is Trump.
Yeah, Trump, certainly, there have been articles on foreign policy, by a few people I respect, with a grain of salt, that Trump has mostly adopted what could be considered a realist foreign policy perspective that isn't fully coherent and laid out.
He's got to throw the jingoism in there in order to get.
There's a lot of jingoism, but it is the fact that it's so divorced from the mainstream of both Republican and Democratic, a liberal interventionist foreign policy.
Right.
Makes it stand out, and he's said some very vague things about Syria, but he's said repeatedly some pretty positive things about his willingness to cooperate with Russia. Sanders has stayed very, very quiet and has been generally supportive of what the U.S. is doing in Syria with some caveats. Of course, there's a question if he was elected, if that would be different.
Well, of course.
That remains to be seen. We do know that Sanders is fairly loyal to Israel, and Israel certainly has a hand and an interest in all of this. Quiet they've played it and close to the chest.
All of them.
So I don't really trust Sanders on it. But the Republicans have actually been somewhat more restrained than Clinton. And Clinton has been perfectly open. She would once again pursue regime change and perhaps with direct U.S. military intervention. Yeah. She has demanded a no-fly zone over northern Syria, which would mean an invasion, and it would mean military confrontation from Russia, which already has its own effective no-fly zone with its very advanced and potent air defense systems, the S-3 and 400s, which it has in Syria and off the coast. The worst case scenario geopolitically, and certainly with regards to Syria and Ukraine, as far as I'm concerned, is a Hillary Clinton, which still seems like the most likely option unless the FBI ends up, you know, Obama's FBI ends up indicting her. Yeah. And that probably isn't going to happen because it is Obama's FBI.
Let me ask you about him, too, about Obama's agency in this. In order to accomplish the, sneak out the side door strategy that Russia is trying to allow the United States, the UK, et cetera, in order to accomplish that, really, the regime change would have to take place in Riyadh and Ankara. And in each case, it really wouldn't take more than just a little breath to blow over Erdogan or the Saudi king. I mean, the people in Saudi Arabia have been musing about it publicly, which normally gets people beheaded, for months. And Ankara, of course, Erdogan has got people lining up outside the presidential palace waiting for him to fall over. So why isn't that being pursued?
I think, first of all, because Russia is not the type of power that goes out to seek to overthrow governments.
I mean by Washington.
Oh, by Washington. Well, Washington doesn't want regime change in either of those countries because it always prefers stability. And both of those countries are still deeply aligned with the United States. I mean, this shows it, more than anything. Saudi Arabia is more and more tied into the United States than less before, even despite souring relations over the Iran deal. I mean, they keep buying tens of billions of dollars of U.S., British, Canadian, German, French weapons every year. Saudi Arabia is either the third or fourth largest importer of arms, spending on defense of countries on the planet. There's some estimates that say Saudi is spending more than Russia on their military now. Yeah. And I think that should scare everyone, considering the nature of this horrible, Wahhabist bloody dictatorship in Saudi Arabia that the U.S. is, very firmly aligned with in what can be called, another special relationship.
The U.S., there's nothing that would stop the U.S. from finding, a friendly inside the Saudi royal family, for example, that wants to, wants to be king, that will do everything that was done before, except will also say, okay, look, we're pulling out of Syria for now. Just keep everything quiet until we give you give you a wink and a nod later, and doing the same in Ankara. I mean, there are certainly people willing to do that. Why aren't they pursuing that, I wonder?
Because the U.S. doesn't want that, because the U.S. still wants regime change. They would prefer to – I see Saudi Arabia, the U.S., and Turkey kind of like a pack of hyenas attacking a lion. What do you want to call it, the Lion of Assad or the Lion of Russia, the same thing. But they're each trying to push the other one forward into a direct confrontation as first. None of the three are entirely sure that they want that, and they would prefer to have someone else take the lead. But none of them are willing at this point to give up on, the proxies that they've invested billions in and made an enemy out of. There was a WikiLeaks cable translated Saudi cable released this week that showed that Saudi Arabia, before the Russian intervention, really misjudged Russia and said that they wouldn't directly intervene. They were sure of that. But they specifically said, but let's not antagonize right. them. Don't ever insult the Russians. And it also shows, if you read it, that they were very, very concerned that they have so much invested at this point that they have to continue with regime change, because if Assad survives, they believe he would seek revenge on them. Mm. And the cable made it clear that they considered that a big threat to them. There's a lot of problems in Saudi Arabia, because we've heard grumblings from the beginning that are a lot of people within the very large royal family, such as it is, that were unhappy with the new king and his firebrand son, who is the defense minister. This is Salman and his son Mohammed Salman, who is the defense minister, and that he is a real hawk, as you will, or an imperialist, whatever you want to call it, and that some people in Saudi Arabia are very unhappy with the way things have gone, not only in Syria with all the money and political capital invested, but also with this geo-economic oil war between Saudi and Russia and Iran that's going on, that has really taxed Saudi's economy and made them cut all kinds of domestic cuts to subsidies on fuel and water and everything else, real scaling back of the economy. But also in Yemen, where this huge, powerful, Western-funded and openly supported invasion of Yemen has really gone south. I mean, they haven't yielded any real advantages on the ground. We know all the time that Yemenis forces and tribes, Houthi tribes and Sunni tribes even, are penetrating into Saudi Arabia. Right. It's being kept very quiet to the majority. There's a Shia minority in Saudi Arabia, but they're a majority on the border in the very important oil-producing region. And this is the soft underbelly of Saudi Arabia. We don't really hear a lot about it, because journalists aren't exactly allowed to report these things in Saudi, most particularly in a war zone. Mm. But this ill-conceived Saudi, U.S. and U.K.-backed Saudi invasion of Yemen, with all of the thousands of, other Gulf dictatorship forces that have been committed, thousands of Colombian and Sudanese mercs have been brought in, and none of it is working. And Yemen is the poorest country in the Middle East. And they're Saudis with all this hundreds of billions of dollars of Western gear. And the U.S. and the U.K. are not just supporting them with, the weapons and the cluster bombs and the jets and everything else. But the U.S. is actively providing C4ISR, intelligence, reconnaissance, refueling their planes in the air. Yep. Every time they run out of cluster bombs, they're refueling them. And the word of the U.K. is they are now openly having advisors on the ground that are supposedly coordinating the bombing in Yemen, which we know – Doctors Without Borders and Amnesty International and everyone, not only is egregiously affecting civilians, but also directly hitting hospitals and so on. And this is all supposedly with the U.S. intelligence and Britain, planning the actual bombing. Right. And on top of that, the U.N. has reported that because of the Saudi Axis blockade, which the U.S. and the U.K. are pursuing against Yemen, there are 14 million people literally starving to death, facing malnutrition and hunger right now.
And thirst.
And this first. But it's Yemen. It's a tiny, little, poor Middle East country that no one cares anything about. The Western journalists, it's their own countries doing it. So, they turn a blind eye to all of it.
Hey,
let me give the Turkey, because you also brought up the weakness of the Turkish regime.
Right.
And this – we've know that there's a strong opposition in Turkey, but there's really – and we know that the nature of this Erdogan regime, he's jailed and killed journalists and academics by the dozens. But he did get elected, and there's really no question of that he has a majority support. But there is a very strong, more secular 40%, 40-45% opposition. And Of course, the problem in Turkey is that for the Turkish military for decades has been the guarantor of a secular Turkish Republic, Ottoman, post-Ottoman, Ataturk Republic,
yeah, right.
In Syria. And it was Erdogan, he's been in power so long, he's thoroughly purged the military again and again and again. Anytime there was rumors of, starting of another military coup to get him as an Islamist out of the government. And it was always tamped down every time. But once again, those rumors are starting to come to the fore. And there was a direct quote reported in the Turkish media by the chief of the general forces, their effective chief of staff. And he said that Turkey would not send military troops into Syria without a Security Council resolution, which we all know isn't coming. Right. So that seemed to be a direct challenge to Erdogan. And there's no guarantee that if he ordered Turkish forces in force to move into Turkey rather than just the bombing and shelling against the Kurds, which he's been doing, that we wouldn't see a military-based rebellion, a junta against him. And if you believe that Russia, after the shooting down of their plane, wouldn't have a hand on all of this, you're sadly mistaken. Mm. And, Erdogan is once again fighting a low-scale civil war across the south and east Turkey with the Kurds. And there have been massacres. There have been a lot of deaths. There have been terrorist bombings. It's a real mess. And Erdogan is sitting on a very weak deck. The Western press loves to talk about how weak Russia is and how the Putin's government could collapse at any time now. They're always predicting that. Every 6 months someone comes out and says it. 15 years later, he's still got an 81% approval rating at the minimum. And more in firm control of Russia than ever before, and genuine popular public support. But the U.S.'s allies in Saudi and Turkey, they look a bit more fragile. Those regimes do. I agree with you. This attempt of Erdogan, to use the civil conflict in Syria as a land grab and for his neo-Ottoman fantasies may very well end up not only in his being regime changed, but also Turkey potentially losing chunks of its own territory to the Kurds as well.
Mm. That point about Putin's popularity vis-a-vis the popularity of the Saudi and Turkish governments is an interesting thing to look at from the United States, where Congress has an 8% favorability rating, which also is about where things are at now in Kiev, isn't it?
Yeah. I would
say
they got
an American-style democracy. They now have a government with 8% support.
Americans are used to having a government that they hate, that is institutionalized as part of the process,
right? Yep.
And it's always directed not against the establishment, but always hatred of the other party and what they're doing in Congress rather than your own. So I think when we hear those numbers out of the U.S., we have to take it with a grain of salt. There's no revolution coming in the U.S.
Hell
not
no.
Until people begin to suffer a lot more. Now, what we have seen is a quiet movement away from the centers of both parties. We've seen that with Trump and Sanders. But certainly Sanders is unfortunately not going to be the nominee of the Democratic Party. He's going to get killed in the South and on Super Tuesday, I believe. And that will basically be time for him to fold it up.
Yeah, we'll keep score on that next week for sure.
I would love to be proven wrong, but I think Clinton has certainly pulled out the bag of dirty tricks in the caucuses in Iowa and Nevada to assure that there's no momentum for him going into that. Trump is beginning to actually, despite my belief that at least in the beginning he wasn't a real candidate but a poison pill.
Mine
he's
too.
Beginning to look like he could really win the Republican Party, and the establishment is terrified because none of the donors are willing to directly take him on. They're that afraid of the amount of support he has. We've got Jeb falling out of the race. We've got Chris Christie endorsing Trump.
Right.
we've got David Duke endorsing Trump, which Trump has then rejected that endorsement. Mm. But there's no question that he's definitely tapped into a very real populist discontent. And, you know, Sanders has done the same thing in the Democratic Party, just to slightly less effect, I believe.
Yeah. He's getting a lot less press than Trump. I mean, he does not. Trump has been featured as the story in the news for almost a year now. And, you know, Sanders, they give him a little insert towards the end.
Yeah. And the thing is, the Western media despises Trump, right? Whether we're talking the mainstream liberal media, you know, the New York Times, you know, the Big Three, the Washington Post, et cetera, you know, the neocons hate Trump as well. In fact, there's a lot of talk among the neocons that if Trump is the candidate, that they'll defect to Clinton, which they see as one of their own.
Of course.
Which I don't think should surprise anyone.
No, not policy-wise.
But there is a real, you know, Trump has really shaken up American politics, and he's done it without spending a dime, you know, in comparison to the other campaigns. He's not paying for campaign ads, because every time he speaks, the Western and even the Fox News media that hates him runs, you know, jumps and leaps to get everything he says because of, you know, ratings, because, you know, they are essentially corporations.
Right. Trump is a creature of the media, and
absolutely.
And there's no such thing as bad publicity. So if they're talking about him all the time, then, you know, he's on TV all the time, and the others are not. So they're not climbing, no matter what else happens. You know, no, there's something about
when
Trump.
When they have been on, like, Rubio, you know, they make disastrous mistakes.
Yeah, there's something going on here, too. This is something I brought up when I did the Mir 24 interview, like, last September or something. Mm-hmm. And I had already been, you know, saying it so long that it just, you know, came out as a chunk out of my brain. Trump's job here has been for decades to license his name out to groups of investors doing projects, whatever they are.
All his money, however much it really is, is entirely just the Trump brand.
That's right.
His name.
On the one hand, the presidential candidacy, of course, is self-financing that way, at least on a ledger sheet, because you see that it's going to be worth more later than it was now because of all the exposure. And, hey, he was a serious presidential candidate. On the other hand,
he is the ultimate cynical postmodern candidate who knows how to manipulate and play the media, not only against, you know, his party, and not only against the people, but against the media itself.
Yep. And on the other hand, the people who don't put their own faces and names out on these buildings are a part of the elite. That's like a hidden part of it. He is the face for a hidden elite, basically. I'm wondering if the elite, whose face we know, at least politically, are scared because of that. And I wonder what it is that they know about the people behind Trump that the public doesn't know.
Yeah, I honestly can't tell you at this point. I know that we've seen very few defections, you know, Chris Christie being one of the most recent ones. Mm. But within, you know, the Republican Party elected officials, you know, the big donors, the, you know, the foreign policy elite, we've seen very few defections to Trump at this point.
Right.
So exactly who is backing? We know that several big, oligarch donors to the Republican Party have now tentatively stepped into the ring against him.
Right.
But, you know, everyone in America, I believe, except for Trump's, populist Republican Fox News created, you know, Frankenstein base,
right,
hates him,
right,
and are just absolutely horrified. But he continues to roll up. And again, I think the Clintons are also very happy about Trump, and then, you know, relations with them through the years. I question what began this all, whether he was a real candidate or not, and how this will all play out with them. But
Yes,
as much as we try not to be interested in it because we know that of the oligarchic nature of the corruption with the right. campaign finance mm-hmm. and the duopoly of the parties, you know, particularly on foreign policy, you know, just two sides of the same coin.
Right.
But it's hard not to be entertained with Trump and Sanders in the race, isn't it?
Yeah, it certainly holds interest. You know, also, we'll go back to, I mean, what I thought, and I know you thought early on, that he was a poison pill so that Hillary Clinton would become president. And now it's actually possible because everyone in the country, except for the people that support Trump now, more or less, are going to be standing behind Clinton.
Yeah, again, unless she's indicted, and top Republican leaders in Congress keep suggesting that she could be. And that Obama is preventing it.
Yeah.
I don't know about, you know, who knows what's going on in the FBI. I certainly don't.
Right.
But they have just recently announced, I believe, that they will subpoena some of her top aides.
Mm.
So that's one step closer. That came out in just the last week, I believe. Check on that. There was definitely some reports on it. And if so, that's one step closer. But I think the Republicans would actually be terrified if Clinton was forced to pull, at least the Republican Party establishment, because, you know, Hillary Clinton is their big savior at this point, because they can't find one of their own. There's talk that they may draft Romney, if Rubio loses Florida. I've heard that mentioned, in the past week.
Yep.
And if Hillary's indicted, be prepared for them to the Democrats to draft Biden to prevent Sanders from then taking it.
Something like that. Yep, she'll hand him over.
If this continuing, you know, Benghazi affair that you really shouldn't be what Americans are focused on in Benghazi. They should be focused on the illegal, violent regime change in the country. What happened? But. You know, this thing with the emails is still hounding Clinton, and it's still this specter looming over the presidential race that could change everything again completely if it does happen. It's very interesting. Do you want to talk about Ukraine?
Yeah, I was going to say that's a good place to jump to, because as amusing as American politics are, there's some real interesting stuff going on in Kiev. Let's talk about that.
But amusing is not the word I would use for it.
Not from the point of view of the people in the East, anyway. Yeah.
We had the U.S.-backed prime minister, Victoria Nuland called. He survived a no-confidence vote in the Ukraine, a political crisis that was instigated when one of the European citizens, a Lithuanian, who had been appointed as economics minister to this putsch government. We had three foreigners. We have an American, a Lithuanian, and a Georgian who were given ministerial positions in the government, supposedly because they can't find uncorrupt Ukrainians among their own to run it. And the Lithuanian accusing a very strong Poroshenko ally, the general prosecutor. He accused the whole government of corruption, but he specifically pointed at this Poroshenko ally who was general prosecutor as inhibiting the reforms that he felt that he was supposed to make to the country on behalf of the IMF and the EU, you know, very neoliberal reforms. His announcement that he was resigning because of this was a big political shock. It called many in Europe's faith into this government in question, how much more money they wanted to throw at it, including the IMF, when one of, you know, their own who was overseeing things as a chaperone was forced to resign out of the fact that he couldn't work with the kids, as it were. and we've had another prominent resignation. And Poroshenko did make this general prosecutor resign, although his loyal deputy is still running things in his place. And he made noises that the prime minister, Yatsenyuk, should be removed. And this isn't a surprise because Yatsenyuk is the most unpopular political figure in Ukraine, with a 1% approval rating. Perhaps that's the most unpopular prime minister in world history. I don't know.
It could be.
But I mean, you don't even have a 5% base, really. Like, right. I mean, you have a 1% approval rating. Right. His government has an 8% approval rating. The president has a relatively popular 17% approval rating. That is 11 points lower than Yanukovych's when he was overthrown in this West-backed putsch. So Yanukovych was more popular than Poroshenko is now. And the most popular figure in the country, political figure in the country that's elected at this point, is the deposed ex-strongman, neoliberal, neocon president of Georgia, Mikhail Saakashvili, McCain's protege, who was chased out of Georgia by his own people over corruption
and the police,
abuse of power, fraud, and you know what boils down to is that his people were literally sodomizing his political opponents who were taken as prisoners in prison, right? And this was exposed with videos and everything that led to his, you know, being chased out of the country after losing an election. And he is a literal fugitive from justice. He's on Interpol, right? The Georgian government wants him back to stand trial for his crimes. You'll never get any Western official or journalist to admit that to him. To them, he's an anti-corruption reformer in Georgia, in Ukraine now. He has been appointed by decree the governor of Odessa, a very a Russian majority town on the Black city on the Black Sea, and he's ruled there. He's not very popular in Odessa or across the rest of East or South Ukraine, but he is very popular in the west of Ukraine and in Kiev. And this popularity means 30%. That's the most popular political figure in Ukraine with 30% support. But there's constant rumors of him angling for either the prime minister job to replace Yatsenyuk yet, or even that he may have somehow a presidential ambitions.
You know, again, this is a hyper-nationalist government, okay? I mean, it rests on hyper-nationalist sentiment in the Western population.
There is a huge hyper-nationalist settlement, but this hyper-nationalism takes a very particular form, right? It comes from Galicia, from this whole Benderite ideology of this Nazi collaborator from World War II that they have legislated as the founding father, the national heroes of the country. Right. But the primary is anti-Russianness, which, of course, is, you know, 30% of their own population, and you know, half of Ukraine has a positive. This is about identity, and about 30% of Ukraine has a very strong pro-Russian identity. You know, with some 20% of them being Russian ethnics themselves, and another 30% of Ukraine in the West have a very anti-Russian conception of Ukrainian identity, again, all forged in this Galician, fascist idea around Stefan Bandera and the Ukrainian insurgent army in World War II. And then the rest of the country kind of sways to either side in the wind. They don't have a strong national sense of identity at all.
Yeah, they just want their paycheck to clear their bank. Like, they just want to make sure they get paid on Friday.
There's big problems with things like now, which is why the government is so unpopular and why 70% of the population thinks the country is moving in the wrong direction. When I'm quoting all these numbers about Ukraine, I'm using the U.S.'s own numbers from the International Republican Institute, the State Department Gongo that loves regime change. I'm using their own numbers that they've conducted for polling. I'm not using any type of Russian or anything else. I'm using their own numbers to show how unpopular this government is right now. And Saakashvili is liked by this 30%. And again, it's the Western ultra-nationalists, not because he's obviously not Ukrainian, but because he's so anti-Russian. And that's what they love about him. And he, God forbid, he actually became president or something like that, because he would probably take the country on some kind of anti-Russian crusade into direct real war with Russia.
Like he did last time.
like he did in Georgia in 2008 when he tried to, reintegrate Abkhazia and South Ossetia, which had UN-approved peacekeeping forces there by force.
Right. So we'll pick up there next week because there's a lot going on in Ukraine that people need to hear here. And
The right sector's going crazy. Yep. Talking about lynching Russian truckers across the country, big protests against this government and this no-confidence vote, again led by the right sector, Azov and the other ultra-nationalists in Kiev, that the Western press is, of course, ignoring. It's a really crazy, unstable time in Ukraine. This was all inevitably coming, and it's still not at the peak yet, but it could very well be this summer.
Could the current government, the Poroshenko government, be the Kerensky to the fascist version of Lenin that we might see coming out of Georgia?
I don't see that. I think they could destabilize this government, but I don't see them taking over the government, because the Western backers that they rely on, remember, this government has entirely been propped up from day minus five by huge amounts of U.S. And EU funding, whether that's direct funding or whether that's through the IMF. Tens of billions of dollars have been poured into this black hole and siphoned off by the oligarchs, who are really running the place. The oligarchs don't want the fascists in charge. They want to be in charge. And that's what this whole no-confidence vote was about. It was them reasserting their control through this no-confidence vote.
Gotcha.
They don't want the fascists in charge. The fascists are a tool. They're a rabid dog. They were what brought it in. They allow this ultra-nationalist sentiment from West Ukraine to allow them to keep political power. But they will not be allowed to sit on the throne, because the West would have to turn directly away from that, because they wouldn't even be able to deny it anymore. You have to understand what happened in the Maidan with the oligarch and the Western backing. That's only because they had front men that they could put out in front, a lot like with what they do in Syria with the exiled Syrian National Committee or Council or whatever it's called now. They always believe they can put these liberal front men on top of the rabid dogs they're using to fight on the streets, whether that's the jihadists in Syria or the neo-Nazis and ultra-nationalists in Ukraine. But they won't be allowed to actually rule things themselves. I don't think there's any possibility of that. But they could bring down the government itself, the regime itself, by fighting against it.
And, they said the same things about Hitler, of course, and we'll pick up there next week.
They did say that. It's different time, different place.
We hope. All right. I'll talk to you next week, Mark. Thank you very much. Pleasure as always.
Thanks for having me, Don. Hey, everyone out there, I'm on social media. I love feedback and taking questions I could bring up on the next conversation.
Mark Sloboda at Facebook. You can find him, and on Twitter. Thanks a lot, Mark.
Thank you.
Bye. You've been listening to CPR Sunday with Don DeBar and Mark Sloboda. Look forward to seeing you drop in again next week.